right, thank you very much. So, Howard Boss will be talking on work, paid and unpaid. Yeah, thank you.
That's the harmony for the song, by the way. I'm saying, talking about myself a little bit. So, I spent the whole of my working life teaching in the university. I considered I was reasonably well paid for the work I did, and the superannuation scheme I paid into yielded what most people regard as a reasonable pension, and still does. So I'm not complaining too much. And the same applied to my workplace staff who finished their careers more or less the same time as me. But if I look at them, they've not all had identical reactions to ending their paid employment. Some of them have carried on with a particular aspect of their work, the work they did before, but independently. It's usually that their academic research. And even though they're no longer paid for it, they seem reasonably happy doing that. Others have been less happy. They found themselves at what you might call a loose end, with no teaching or associated work to be done. And they don't see the point in carrying on with their research, given that it's no longer connected to a day job. They see working in isolated fashion no longer affording them the recognition, the approbation of their colleagues and of their wider academic community, as it did before. I ran into one such former colleague some time ago, several months after he retired in his early 60s. I asked him how things were going. He seemed pretty miserable, and his reply was, "I'm bored out of my skull." He sounded and looked angry and frustrated. I didn't know what to say other than to wish him all the best. So these are two possible reactions to no longer having paid work to do. But there's also a third category, a third type of reaction from those who, having finished their paid employment, feel they've been sort of set free. And that's made them decide to involve themselves in quite different activities, usually unpaid. Sometimes it's a continuation of the work which they devoted time and energy to before in their spare time. They can now devote themselves more to those things. Sometimes this means simply spending more time with, say, family or grandchildren, or it might be political or social activity of one kind or another, such as campaigning, charity work, being part of a voluntary group of some kind, or something like that. One of the things I personally began to do on retirement, and still do, was to play short mat indoor bowls in my local community centre. And as a result of that, I was recruited onto the committee of the community centre. And I found that two of my former work colleagues, now retired like me, were also part of it. One of them was also heavily involved in helping to organise a local food bank, you know, the kind we know sprung up in recent times, increasing numbers. A common factor in all this was the obvious satisfaction that people like this derived from their new unpaid work, their new unpaid activity anyway. You can call it work if you like. It depends how you want to look at it. But it's sort of non-professional activity for them. As I say, most of them wouldn't regard it as work as such. There's certainly no suggestion of any kind of recompense or money or anything like that for the activity. Rather, the main driver seems to be a perception that they're doing something communally useful and feeling a sense of community, and also the approval, the approbation of the people around them. For my own part, apart from the activities I've already mentioned, there are two other things which have absorbed my own time in a practical and satisfying way since retirement. The first has been increased activity in the trade union I'm still a member of, albeit a retired one. I handle personal cases or pension matters for members, and I've got more time to do this than others who also volunteer for union work, but they still have sort of paid jobs. The second activity has been playing an increased part in Socialist Party work, helping to organise my local branch, giving talks, going to events to try and spread the socialist message, and also writing columns and articles for the party's journal of the Socialist Standard. In this connection, since the beginning of 2022, since the beginning of last year, therefore, I've contributed a regular back page column to the Standard with the byline Life and Times. And in doing this, I focus very much on the kind of discussion of personal experience of life in capitalism that I'm talking about here. I've also contributed book reviews for Socialist Standard, and a number of these have been about books on the subject of work in its various different aspects. It's definitely an area there's a good deal of interest in at present, arising especially, at least it seems to me, from the fact that in recent times, say in the last 30 or 40 years, what you might call the complexion of employment has changed in becoming increasingly what I would call more hierarchised. The kind of flat structures in the workplace that were being much talked about, say in the 1960s and 70s, haven't materialised. People thought that's the way things would go. Many people did anyway. But what's actually happened is the opposite. They've given way to more rigid, more authoritarian line management systems, whereby everyone has got someone higher up standing over them, kicking them up the backside, assessing them, judging their work or productivity, and sometimes actually terrorising them. A lot of us have probably seen this. Various terms have been invented to try and sort of mask this, to give a sort of softening impression of it. Lean production is one of the names sometimes given to it. And a recent, more recent buzz term is agile working. That's very prevalent at the moment. But it's also more correctly, I think, been called management by stress. And in the book Bullshit Jobs, published in 2019, the author, David Graeber, refers to it as managerial feudalism. The handout I've given you has got various quotations, which I'm going to read out. It's also got, open page, a list of works mentioned. And that's the first one at the bottom of that page, David Graeber, Bullshit Jobs. And I'll refer to these as I progress. In the worst case, anyway, this consists of workers being put, sort of put on trial every year, or sometimes more frequently, with their efficiency judged by their manager on the basis of whether they've met their so-called KPIs. That's another sort of buzz term, isn't it? Yeah. Key performance indicators. And this with the shadow of a possible capability process hanging over them, which can potentially lead to dismissal. And the irony here, of course, is that the manager conducting the KPI operation
is it crept in?
but usually, her or himself, they're also subject to the same process of oppression at the hands of the person who is their manager. It's hard here not to be reminded of something in Oscar Wilde's famous essay, The Soul of Man Under Socialism, where he writes, and this is the first quotation on your handout, all authority is quite degrading. It degrades those who exercise it and degrades those over whom it is exercised. A recent YouTube video by a very bright bloke called Eric Schechter, entitled Only Revolution Can Save Life on Earth, the way he frames it, it's quite simple. Workplaces are dictatorships. That's quite good.
That was quite a sort of
simple but effective way to describe it. But I'll now go back more specifically to work in universities, since it's part of my personal experience. And I'll say that however much things have got worse for workers in universities, There are certainly far worse, more authoritarian, more soul-destroying forms of employment. No illusions about that. There are, for example, jobs of various kinds perceived as completely pointless by those doing them. And some of these form the subject matter of the book I've just mentioned, bullshit jobs. They're usually office or what used to be called white-collar jobs, jobs of a service or administrative nature of some kind. And of course, many other jobs, whether administrative or manual or anything else, clearly are pointless in the sense that in any kind of organisation of society, such jobs are apparently unpleasant, it would probably still need to be done. So these are not bullshit jobs in the sense that Graeber uses the term. But of course, the conditions in which they're done, and often the pay for them, are likely still to make those who do them feel dissatisfied and alienated. And jobs like these, actually, Graeber refers to not as bullshit jobs, but as shit jobs. And just to take this a little bit further, in another recent book entitled Wageless Life by Ian Shaw and Marv Waterstone, that's the recent edition of the Oscar Wilde book, or the book in which that essay is contained, and this is the Wageless Life book, A Manifesto for a Future Beyond Capitalism by Shaw and Waterstone. And in this book, the authors describe work of whatever kind under capitalism as, I think this is quote number two on your handout, yes it is, a scramble to sell our energies under conditions of duress and unfreedom. And they talk about it as a war of profit against life on earth. They say workers are being denied the ability to control how they work, and shades of what Richard was saying in his talk on Friday, they suffer an alienation that separates them from the material conditions that allows humans to flourish. And they go on to say that capitalism fosters the utter worship of paid work, and in so doing, and this is also on your handout, thrives on producing docile subjects who are alienated by from their surroundings. Their conclusion, or one of their conclusions, is we live in a world sculpted by money but populated by the moneyless. Quite sort of effectively expressed there. But they haven't got the same kind of solution as us, as I'll mention shortly. However, we've got to recognise that it wouldn't be fair to characterise all paid employment in capitalism as either bullshit jobs or shit jobs or jobs that cause alienation. It would be too sweeping not to recognise that despite the conditions and limitations of wage and salary work, some jobs can give workers significant pleasure or satisfaction. But at the same time, that doesn't take away that overall condition of duress and unfreedom that was mentioned, which is inherent in wage and salary work. And in particular, it doesn't exempt most workers from the intensification we're seeing, which I've mentioned, of rigid, unforgivingly hierarchical employment practices. But nothing is absolute, and there's also been some questioning of this intensification process. I'd say over the last 10 to 20 years, there's been considerable discussion about whether work couldn't be organised more effectively and efficiently, and even more humanely, but without looking outside the profit system. And as part of this, there have even been some examples, much talked about actually, if you're interested in that kind of area of things, of companies instituting freer, less rigid work structures and even more equal pay. And I've got a couple of examples of this which were brought to my attention. One of the most striking ones is in the American Valve video game company, the Valve, apparently well known amongst people who are interested in video games. And here the owner established a completely flat, non-directed structure on the ground that people work better and more efficiently when they're relaxed and don't feel they're being watched over and judged all the time. Another is the financial services company, of all things, Gravity Payments, in the States, like Valve, where the CEO decided to pay all the staff a wage of $70,000 a year, that being the amount he decided was necessary to live what he called a normal life. This compared with the previous average salary in that firm of $48,000 a year. And at the same time, amazingly, he slashed his own salary of $1.1 million a year to the $70,000. He probably had other money slashed away too, but never mind. That's what he did. Elsewhere, the reaction to hierarchy and authoritarian work practices in capitalism has gone further. We often hear about a sort of beneath-the-radar movement among at least a small number of people to reject the sort of competitiveness of wage and salary work on the grounds that it's life-sapping. Not that they don't work at all or don't participate in the buying and selling system, but they try to lead what I've heard called a low-desire life without grueling competition. And this was highlighted in a recent BBC radio programme in the series The Digital Human by the presenter Alex Krotowski. It's a serious programme, and she talked about how in China, of all places, which incidentally she referred to as the most competitive society on earth, interesting that one, she referred to how in China a good number of young people are managing to opt out and in preference to try and lead that low desire life. Don't know what the evidence is for that. She didn't sort of present specific evidence, but as I say, it's a serious programme, so I suspect there's at least something in it. Going further still and closer to the Socialist Party's view that the nature of work can only be fundamentally altered by a new social system, there are a number of things worth mentioning. A TED talk, probably heard of these TED talks, a TED talk from the University of Edinburgh in 2018, given by Jade Saab, was entitled A World Without Money. It's on your list of other works mentioned on over the page on the handout, Jade Saab, A World Without Money, TED talk 2018. And he asked the question, what would happen if everything was free? It was very good, actually. One section of his talk was entitled Why and How We Work Will Be Different. Very interesting indeed. And the party's been in contact with this speaker. And he said he would be prepared to be involved in discussion with us. Maybe we should have invited him here. Maybe I should have thought of that. And then, of course, there's Zeitgeist, the so-called Venus Project, with their case for what they call the resource-based economy. They've got a whole series of YouTube talks, and one of them formed the subject of one of our Friday evening discussion events not too long ago. And I think most people present found that talk very much echoed our own arguments. One or two sort of bits and pieces that maybe we wouldn't fully agree with, but nevertheless, pretty close. And there are a number of Facebook groups whose names speak for themselves. There's one called Moneyless Society, there's one called World of Free Access, and there's one called, very good one, called A Group Around the World Where We Are All Anti-Capitalists. And there's definitely some interesting stuff on these sites. And this is matched on paper by more than just a few writers, mainly academics, who propose various different kinds of non-hierarchical work organisation. The problem, of course, with some of these proposals is that when looked at closely, they amount to utopian ways of reorganising capitalism, which the system by its very nature simply couldn't implement because, you know, they do go against the needs of the system. Anitra Nelson's recent book, Beyond Money, A Post-Capitalist Strategy, is one of these, actually. That's
the ref, she's number three
on the handout. There's a quote from her which I'll read in a moment. But Anita Nelson's recent book, which I couldn't find to bring along with me to show you, but this is a book which she was involved in editing earlier. Also, it's called Life Without Money, Building Fair and Sustainable Economies. And our own Alan Newey has actually got a chapter in this. Anita Nelson, in her book, Beyond Money, a Post-Capitalist Strategy, sums the kind of thing I've just mentioned up well, you know, the way in which people who say they want, you know, work to be better, more firmly organised, still don't go outside the sort of capitalist spectrum. And she says, and this is quote three on your handout, modified forms of money and markets are included or inferred in practically all visions of post-capitalism, and all attempts to mould money to progressive ends are bound to fail, because the vast majority will still be able to enjoy the full benefits of their everyday work and have little say in how they live and work. And the way she sums it up is, we cannot tweak the system to overcome its weaknesses. So she sees all attempts, no matter how well-meaning, to actually make things significantly better in terms of work and the effects on people within capitalism is bound to fail. And these flaws pointed to by this writer, Anita Nelson, are also to be found in otherwise perceptive books about work, such as this one, which is Daniel Susskind's A World Without Work, Technology, Automation, and How We Should Respond, published in 2020. And also in this book by Michael D. Yates, Work, 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 Labour, Alienation, and Class Struggle. And that's also the case, by the way, for the book I mentioned a bit earlier, The Wageless Life by Short and Waterstone. And I said that despite its title and various other things, it doesn't actually recommend a world without money and without buying and selling. But even if the conclusions of writers like these fall short of advocating a completely different social order, or thinking that that may be possible in the foreseeable future, they can still have a lot of powerfully relevant things to say about work and its meaning in human society. Susskind, for example, while, as I said, in the end, not going beyond buying and selling, describes work, and this is quote four on your handout, describes work as a source of meaning, purpose, and direction in life, with community recognition of that work rather than wages, fulfilling the human longing for personal fulfillment and social interaction. Very well expressed, I thought, anyway. And Shore and Waterston, who I've just mentioned, talk about, this is quote five on your handout, decolonizing our minds of the entrenched common sense of what constitutes meaningful work and its connection to happiness, identity, and self-worth. And Michael B. Yates, the work man, goes even further, and this is quote six on the handout I've given you. He says, regarding work, we should strive for a society in which this word is no longer used except to describe the past. What we are as human beings is a species that can thoughtfully produce what is needed for survival and enjoyment. Only cooperative and beneficial production with substantive equality in all aspects of life, instead of becoming habituated to misery, exploitation and appropriation, we will take for granted that most profound maxim, from each according to ability to each according to need. When this necessity is realised, only then will we be free. A pity then that the same writer, Michael B. Yates, also tend to advocate reforms of various kinds. However, others have gone further still and have not concluded that, despite the fact this is what we want ultimately, we need reforms in the meantime. And they concluded that the production and distribution of goods and services as a whole needs to take place in a completely different kind of social setup, a moneyless one of economic equality that most of us here would call socialism. Examples of this kind of work, the kind of work in which this is proposed and discussed, are, and this is number 8 on your handout, it's Aaron Benenau, Automation and the Future of Work, published in 2021. It's a key work that I'll come back to it in a moment. And there's another one which is called Description of the World of Tomorrow, a world without money or bond or exchange, a civilization of free access, by two French writers, Jean-François Petitjean and Marc Chinal, published in 2021. And the previously mentioned Beyond Money, a post-capitalist strategy by Henrik Nelson. That's from 2022. There's Moneyless Society, which is in the list of works mentioned over the page of your handout at the bottom, by Matthew Holton, also published last year, 2022. And in particular, the most recent books, the most recent book of this description I've come across anyway, is one called, and it's also on your list of the page, at the bottom of page 2 of the handout. It's a book by Troy Vertese and Drew Pendergrass called Half Earth Socialism, A Plan to Save the Future from Extinction, Climate Change and Pandemics. And if you faithfully read this month's Socialist Standard, you'll see that there's actually an interview with one of these authors about his views on the future of work and indeed the future of the earth, Drew Pendergrass. There was a review of this book 2 or 3 months ago, and he agreed to be interviewed by the Socialist Standard, and there's a review in and his interview is in this month's Standard, then with a sort of comment by the editors, a bit, some of which is a bit critical, but fair enough. Now, while these works don't all necessarily advocate precisely the same vision of a future socialist society as the Socialist Party does, they do have in common the idea that while work is a basic need, it does not and should not have to take the form of paid employment. For the two French writers I mentioned, and this is quote 8, quote 7 on your sheet. Money is a tool of exchange, but wherever we care to look, a tool of exclusion. For them, the downsides of employment for money are the imposition of a daily stretch of work, lack of variety, hierarchical organisation, and the potential precariousness of keeping your job, things we all recognise, I think. And they characterise work in a potential, what they call post-monetary society, as they call it, as a means of achieving a socially desired result, with all non-socially productive activities disappearing. And here they're talking about, when they talk about socially non-productive activities, they're talking about things that we're familiar with and which I mentioned very effectively in the party pamphlet that was produced many years ago called it tries to go into detail about the kind of things that you wouldn't need in socialism, and stuff like armaments, insurance and banking, sales promotion, taxation, legal contracts, etc. In their vision of a future society, all work that takes place does so because it's useful and necessary, with no stigma attached to any of it. They also raise the question, and it's a question we've all heard many times, who will do the dirty work? And their answer is quite simple. Change the system and the very concept of dirty work would disappear. Vertithin Pendergrass, who I've just mentioned, the one interviewed in the Standard, goes even further than this in a sense. They attempt to map out a kind of blueprint for planning what they call their half-earth system by outlining what a day in the life might be in a future society. And, you know, they acknowledge the contribution of William Morris to this society, organised democratically without monetary accounting, and which needs, in their opinion, half the earth set aside for nature to be allowed free reign, so half-earth socialism. They call it a society of comfortable abundance and one in which humans will not, as now, be set on destroying their environment and their future. At the same time, they do disclaim some of the responsibility for the detail they got into this by labelling it a thought experiment. It's a very interesting thought experiment. Once again, some echoes of one of the talks, was it Richards? I'm not sure, in which the point was made that these thought experiments are all well and good, but we can't know what kind of position society will be in when we get socialism. So it's very hard to actually, you know, go into details about how socialism will be organised. I'll also just mention that a writer called James Zussman, who's also he's the last name on your handout at the bottom of the second page, who authored a book in 2017 called Affluence Without Abundance, The Disappearing World of the Bushmen. Despite the without in the book's title, Affluence Without Abundance, he actually says something very similar to Vertithin Pendergrass. He suggests there will be abundance, what they call comfortable abundance. But among these various works, the one that's probably closest to the socialist populist concept, both of the nature of work and how it can be organised in a non-monetary society, is Aaron Benenau's Automation and the Future of Work. And there are various quotes from Benenau. That's number 8 on your handout. In his final chapter in particular, which is entitled Necessity and Freedom, the author talks about, and this is quote 8a, the abolition of private property and monetary exchange in favour of planned cooperation. A world of fully capacitated individuals in which every single person can look forward to developing their interests and abilities with full social support. He then goes on to advocate a society in which, and this is 8b, everyone can go to the social storehouses and service centres to get what they need. For most people, the first time in their lives that they could enter truly voluntary agreements without the gun to their heads of a pervasive material insecurity. He also goes on to say that community life will be what he calls disalienated, in that it will be taken under what he calls democratic control and collective care. And quote HC, we would divide up the responsibilities while taking into account individual aptitudes and proclivities, with some tasks needing to be performed locally, but many capable of being planned on a regional or global scale using advanced computer technologies. His final conclusion, and this is AD, is that the realm of freedom would be the one giving rise to all manner of dynamism. That is where human beings would invent new tools, instruments, and methods of accounting, as well as new games and gadgets, rapidly reallocating resources over time and space to suit changing human tastes. The world would then be composed of overlapping partial plans with interrelated necessary and free activities, rather than a single central plan. That's one perception, anyway, one idea, one vision, if you like, of how socialism could be organised. But how and when will this realm of freedom that Ben and Ab talks about come about? Well, we, i.e. the Socialist Party, have a take on the how, that is by mass democratic political action, but obviously much less sure of the when. No one, in fact, knows, but in this area, something said recently by a commentator most of us will know, George Monbiot, was definitely interesting. Monbiot is someone we agree with on a good many things. He's definitely a first-class communicator, but at the same time, he is at bottom very much a reformist. However, what he said was interesting, and this is quote 9, "So many new ideas have come from the fringes. Society is like an amoeba. It moves from the margins, not from the centre." Very interesting. I thought it was anyway, and hard to disagree with, and perhaps it gives some succour to us from the fringes. So to conclude, we're not talking about strategies within capitalism for dealing with problems thrown up by that system. Problems, for example, like climate change or destruction of the environment or some, you know, unsatisfactory working conditions. We all know that strategies for or proposed solutions to those problems are inevitably seen through a lens of trying to find how things can be tweaked for production, consumption and work to carry on much as before. That's the way it's perceived within the system. Another example of attempting to fix things within the framework of the current system might be plans for example, for finding replacement work for those who may lose their jobs or may not lose their jobs, as a study suggesting through automation. But what we're talking about, rather, is a society in which people will no longer have to do jobs that they do not necessarily like or may even hate just for the money. They will be able to do work they want to do and really enjoy doing. And if there are some jobs that are less popular, there's no reason why more automation and use of robotics could not take care of at least most of this. Above all, one of the first things that will end in a socialist society is the link between work and consumption. What people will consume will not depend on the amount of work that they do. This was one of William Morris's main points in his pamphlet called self-descriptively manual work versus useless toil. People will cooperate to do the work that makes society function, and they will make decisions democratically in workplaces, in local communities, in regions, and for some policy decisions, no doubt even globally. Okay, we don't, we can't absolutely sure of that, but we can say it's quite likely. But above all, there will no longer be top-down control by leaders, by governments, by bosses, and no more will money control people's lives. I had a chat with the chap on reception here yesterday, and I said, I've heard this place is closing. He said, yes, it is. I said, you know, why is that? First word he said was, it's going to be money. Money, he said. Well, that's interesting. You should come to one of our talks. I've sort of finished now, but I'll conclude with William S. Burroughs' famous words, which are the last quote on your handout, which says, "What does the money machine eat? It eats youth, spontaneity, life, beauty, and above all, it eats creativity. It eats quality and shits quantity." Thank you very much.